Well, back to the book of Ecclesiastes after a couple of weeks away. You recall that this book, was written by King Solomon to investigate the meaning of life. And in it, he explores various elements of life to discover their value in bringing fulfillment to men and women upon the earth. A number of areas, such as wealth and the things that money can buy, sensual pleasures such as wine and food, art, music, and sex, intellectual pursuits, wisdom and knowledge, and labor, the satisfaction of accomplishing tasks here in this life. And the question is, can any of these things or others like them produce lasting fulfillment in our lives here upon the earth? And the answer to that question is twofold. First of all, no. No, if they are pursued apart from God. But the second answer is yes. Yes, if God is first in our focus and in our affections, and everything else in life is subordinated to God's sovereign rule and to His revealed will. And so today we move into chapter 3 to see what else King Solomon, by the Spirit of God, has to teach us about these things. And I think there are two main instructions in chapter 2, or chapter 3 rather. Number one, Solomon exhorts us to understand the appointments of life in verses 1 through 11. And then secondly, to live in the light of eternity, verses 12 through 22. And let's examine how these two instructions unfold. First of all, we need to understand the appointments of life, both that God appoints the circumstances of our lives and God appoints the perplexities of our lives. We need to understand both of those things if we're going to understand life as we must live it here upon the earth. And God it is who appoints the circumstances of our lives. And that's the real thrust of this poem that opens chapter 3. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted, and so forth. One of the best-known sections of this book of Ecclesiastes. It is, in fact, a Hebrew poem. The word time is mentioned 28 times in 14 pairs. It's a beautiful poem, really. And it is designed, I believe, to depict all of the events of our lives from birth to death, and a lot of what's in between. And obviously, nobody could list every single element of possible circumstance and event in our lives. But the comprehensiveness of this poem is there to portray all of life, all of the events of life, everything that comes into our life, everything that we experience, both the positives and the negatives, both the things that we enjoy and the things that we struggle with. They are all part of life, but here's the point. They are all appointed by God. And that's the main idea of this section. Oftentimes, this poem is understood as a prescription for wise living. And it is. If you take the truth of this poem and apply it to the various areas of life, it will be helpful to you to understand that there is a proper time to sing, and there's a proper time to mourn, and so forth, all through this poem. Of course, those things are true. A proper time to speak, a proper time to be quiet. May God give us wisdom to know when those times are. And we can do that all the way through these pairs of times in our lives. But the main idea is to understand that God is the one who appoints all of these things. God appoints our birth as well as our death. That's the way it all begins, and nobody would argue with that statement. We don't control our birth. We don't control our death. We don't control the time of our birth. God appoints that. We don't control the time of our death. God appoints that. And as that is true in those extremes at the beginning and at the end, it is just as true with everything that is in between. God appoints it all. That's what Solomon wants us to realize. The New American Standard opens this book, this chapter, with these words in the way it is translated in their version, there is an appointed time for everything. There is an appointed time for everything. And of course, that raises the question, if everything is appointed, who does the appointing? We certainly don't. God does. And that is the idea of this. This is another way of saying our times are in God's hands. The events of our lives are in God's hands. All of the circumstances that we experience are appointed by God. And there's a reason for them. And some of that will be given to us as the chapter unfolds. But we need to understand that from the very beginning. God appoints the circumstances of our lives. And furthermore, maybe a subcategory under the broader category of God appoints everything in our lives, but particularly in verses 9 through 11, God appoints the perplexities of life. Those areas of our life that are puzzling and difficult and we struggle to understand. He returns to the theme of human labor in verse 9 as he has previously. What profit, he says, has the worker from that in which he labors? It's that question that's designed to cause us to stop and think. He first raised that question in chapter 1, verse 3, remember? Where he said, what profit has a man from all his labors in which he toils under the sun? He doesn't answer the question in chapter 1, but we begin to see pieces of the answer as the book unfolds. He raises the question again in chapter 3. And again, there's not a direct answer that is a complete answer, but pieces of the answer are given to us along the way. And the idea is, think about this. What is the meaning of all of this toil and labor? Why are we working? What are we working for? What's the meaning of life? What's the meaning of all of this labor? All of these struggles to make a living and to achieve and to acquire in life. What is the purpose of that? Stop and think about this. It is truly perplexing to arrive at an understanding of this if you don't take all of the revealed information into account. The meaning of life. In verse 10, I have seen, he says, the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. Well, he's already said that in a different way in chapter 1, verse 13, remember? Speaking about himself in verse 13 of chapter 1, he says, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven, this burdensome task. It's not easy to figure out the meaning of life and all of the elements of life as we live them out under heaven. It's not an easy thing to figure out. This burdensome task God has given, and he's already told us that God had given it to him, and that's why he was working at it. But now he broadens that statement in verse 13 of chapter 1 to say, God has given to the sons of men, by which they may be exercised. We're all supposed to be occupied with trying to figure out the perplexities of life, the meaning of life, why all these circumstances are brought into our lives, and what is the reason for them and the meaning for them. That's the task that God has given to all of us. He gave it to Solomon, the wisest man, we are told, who certainly of his day and maybe whoever lived. And Solomon explored these things probably better than we can because he had the resources to do so. Nobody was wealthier than Solomon, so he could explore all the things that money can buy. Few people are as wise as Solomon, so he could explore intellectual pursuits better than most people, and so forth. He did all of this, and he becomes a guide for us, but he didn't do it so we don't have to. He did it so we can do it better, so we've got a little bit better understanding as to how to understand the meaning of life. This is a mystery, it is perplexing, but God wants us to wrestle with it because there is benefit even in the difficulty of understanding these things. And then he gets to this interesting statement in verse 11. where he tells us that we must have the perspective of eternity if we're going to be able to understand these things. He, we read in verse 11, God has made everything beautiful in its time. Lovely statement. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. So there are three important things that we learn in verse 11. Number one, God's appointments are good. We might have assumed that. He's told us that everything in our life is there by the appointment of God. Even the difficulties and perplexities are part of God's appointment for us. But now he wants us to understand clearly, without any question, without wondering about this, let's understand this truth, that everything is beautiful in its time. Everything is good. Everything is fitting. Everything is appropriate, are various ways that we could accurately translate that word. Everything is designed by God to be appropriate and fitting and good and beautiful in our lives. Everything. That's a statement of divine revelation. We're called upon to accept it and believe it. We will not necessarily always understand it. We who are God's children know that all things work together for the good of those who love God, to those who are the called according to His purpose. We don't always understand how that is true as we wrestle with the trials and sorrows and difficulties and disappointments of life. But we know by divine revelation that it is true. And this is really the Old Testament version of Romans 8:28. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Notice again, he uses that word time that he used, 28 times in the opening poem. He comes back to it now. This is linked to what he said there. All of these circumstances of life, the time to be born, and the time to die, the time to plant, the time to pull out what was planted, all of these things which make up the times of our lives, all of those are beautiful. God has appointed everything beautiful in its time. It's beautiful in the place where God has put it, in the time in our life where God has put it. It's perfectly designed by God, and it's good. God's appointments are good. But we can only understand that, as he will go on to show us, as these things are viewed from an eternal perspective. We can't get to the bottom of that if we're only dealing with the things under the sun, in this life upon the earth. But when we view this from an eternal perspective, we can at least understand that the statement is true, even though all the details we will not fully understand now. Maybe we will understand them better when we're with the Lord in eternity. But that's the second thing of verse 11. The first thing is that God's appointments are good. The second thing is what I've called God's revelation is revolutionary. Because what does he say next? First, he has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, this in addition, he, that is God, has put eternity in their hearts. God has put eternity. God has put forever in their hearts. In whose hearts? In the hearts of the sons of men, the sons and daughters of men, the people, human beings. In their hearts, God has put eternity. And what does he mean by that? God has put in the heart of every person a sense that this life is not all there is. That life exists beyond the grave. We understand that if we don't understand it fully and perfectly, as none of us do. But we all understand that, even if we've never read a Bible. We all have a sense that man is grander, is greater, is more than earthly life. There's something bigger, there's something better, there's something beyond the grave. God has given that to us. That's one of those revelations of truth that God has placed in the soul of every person, along with other foundational revelations that we read about, for example, in Romans chapter 1, things that God has revealed to every man. And this is one of them. God has revealed to every person a sense that this life is not all. There is something beyond the grave. And that distinguishes us from animals. Now, in a moment, he's going to tell us in what ways we are like the animals, or what way in particular. But before he gets to that, he tells us how we differ from animals. No animal has a sense of eternity in his heart. No animal has a sense of life beyond the grave. No animal has a sense of a never-dying soul. But we do. And why do we? Because God has put it there. And that's why nothing on earth alone can produce complete satisfaction, because we need this additional understanding and to act upon that understanding in order to bring ultimate fulfillment from eternity, from heaven, from life beyond the grave, and bring that understanding down into the present life that we live. And that will give life meaning here upon the earth. So the first thing we learn in verse 11 is that God's appointments are good, every one of them. The second thing is that God's revelation is revolutionary. This changes everything. If all there is life between birth and death, we go to the grave, that's it, it's over, it's gone. That brings one perspective to life. But oh, as soon as we understand that that is not all, that there is life beyond the grave, that we have a never-dying soul, that there is a God above who made us for Himself and who calls us to Himself, and that there's life beyond the grave, oh, that changes everything. That revolutionizes our whole understanding of life. And then thirdly, verse 11 tells us that God's ways are beyond human comprehension. And this is an interesting perplexity, another one of these perplexities of life. God has put eternity in their hearts. And my version has a really good translation of this next phrase. Not all versions are quite as clear. But we read, going back again, He has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. God has put an understanding of eternity in our hearts, but He hasn't given us the ability to understand everything about eternity. He hasn't given us an ability to understand everything that He is doing in eternity. All that God has done and is doing from beginning to end, God hasn't given us that capacity. He's given us enough capacity to know that there's life beyond the grave, to know that we are not animals, to know that there is a God above and that He is ruling this universe and that we must relate to Him, for He made us and our lives are under His control. But to understand all of what He's doing, we do not understand, nor can we understand what that's about to a very great degree. Most of God's ways are beyond human comprehension. What little we do understand requires divine revelation. We wouldn't know any of this if God didn't reveal it to us. And God controls the degree of revelation that we shall have. We're shut up to God. He reveals as much as He wants us to know, and He shuts the door on our understanding beyond what He wants us to know. Now, that, of course, brings all kinds of perplexities to those who aren't willing to submit to God's sovereign rule, His right to do this. I demand to know more. Who are you? Who am I to be demanding of the potter that he do this or that with the vessels that he's making with the clay? That's not my prerogative. That's his. God controls the degree of revelation that we will have, and therefore we must trust the wisdom of God. We cannot understand all of the circumstances. We don't know exactly what he's doing and why. We frankly couldn't really understand it if he told it all to us, but God wisely doesn't tell us more than we can understand. God gives us what he wants us to know and what he will enable us to understand, and then he closes the door of understanding on those things that he does not intend to reveal to us. His ways are far above our ways. His ways are past our finding out. And therefore, we must trust the wisdom of God. That is, we must trust that God is wise. He does know what he's doing. And we trust him to work these things out as he said he would, making everything beautiful in its time. No. I want to make those decisions. Sorry, they're not yours to make. No. I want to pass judgment on what I consider to be beautiful and not beautiful of the things that you have done. Sorry, you have two choices. Either accept what I have said and live comfortably, live thankfully, live peacefully in that much information, and the rest you yield it to God and say, Lord, I trust you in your wisdom to work all these things out according to your wise design. Or we can just kick against this all of our lives and be like the one who is kicking against the pricks. That's hard, isn't it? You just bloody yourself when you do that. What he's telling us here is that both the desire to know as well as the limitations to our understanding are ordained by God. God's put eternity in our hearts, so we'll have a desire to know. If we were like the animals, that thought wouldn't even cross our minds. But he's put it there. So we want to know. But not only the desire to know, but the limitations to our understanding are ordained by God. Even so, because it seemeth good in thy sight, O Lord. And so we must understand the appointments of life. But number two, we must live in the light of eternity, and that's verses 12 through 22. And what does that mean, to live in the light of eternity? And how do we do this? And Solomon will help us. In fact, let me give you four statements, and then I will go back and explain them one by one. But what does it mean to live in the light of eternity, and how do we do this? Number one, accept life on earth as a gift from God. That's first. Accept life on earth as a gift from God. Number two, accept the circumstances of life as appointments of God. Third, accept the injustices of life as the domain of God. And number four, accept the trials of life as the instructors of God. Number one, accept life on earth as a gift from God, verses 12 and 13. I know, said Solomon, that nothing is better for them, that is for the sons of men, than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Be content with the life that God has ordained for you. Only then can you enjoy the good things that God provides. Only when you accept them as his good gifts. I know people who go all through life discontent, unhappy, because they don't like what God has ordained for their lives. And they are not willing to accept the elements of their life, the times that God has appointed for their lives, as good gifts from God. They are determined to see them as bad things, and they're unhappy about them. And they insist on remaining unhappy about them. And they go through life complaining about them and being discontent. And it's no wonder you never come to any peace and satisfaction, because you are not willing to accept what God has appointed for your life as God's wise and gracious gift to you. He deals with every one of us differently. None of us have the same circumstances in our lives. None of us have the same blessings. None of us have the same trials. None of us have the same events. Every one of us are different and unique. But the point is that every one of us experience exactly what God has appointed for us. God gave you the parents He gave you. God gave you the intellect that He gave you, the gifts and the talents that you have. God gave you the opportunities and lack of them that are in your life. God gave you the physical characteristics that you have, the color of your hair and the color of your eyes and your height. I don't know if I should say weight. Did God do that? But all of these characteristics, even those that are changeable, that we can work on one way or another, the parameters are all ordained by God, aren't they? Now, you can either reject that to your misery, or you can accept that to your blessing. You can either live in the light of time on earth and all of these things that you see and don't come to terms with, aren't happy about, or you can live in the light of eternity. God above has done these things, and in His time will no doubt show you the other side of the tapestry. We've all heard that illustration about the weaver and the back side of the tapestry, how tangled it looks and how ugly it is until you flip it over and see the beautiful tapestry that was woven. And that's exactly the way it is. And in eternity, God will show you the beauty of it. Now, the question is, will you trust Him now? Will you accept it now? Will you yield to His sovereign rule now? That will be to your blessing. To live in the light of eternity means to accept life on earth as a gift from God. Number two, to live in the light of eternity means to accept the circumstances of life as appointments by God. This overlaps the first one a bit, and I've already dealt with it some. But that's verses 14 and 15. I know that whatever God does, it shall be done forever. Nothing can be added to it, nothing taken from it. For God does it, that men should fear before Him. That which is has already been, that which is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what is past. Accept the circumstances of life as appointments from God. All of these elements in your life, whatever they may be, are the working out of God's changeless decrees. You can kick and chafe and object, but you're not going to change a thing. You can't add to it. You can't subtract from it. It's already appointed. It's already settled by an omnipotent, omniscient, gracious, loving God. So accept the circumstances of life as appointments of God, the working out of God's changeless decrees, designed for a reason. He tells us why. To produce fear of God. Again, verse 14. Nothing can be added to it, nothing taken from it. God does it. Why? That men should fear before Him. The elements of life, and particularly the perplexities of life, are designed to drive us to God. If we're self-sufficient, we don't tend to feel our need of God, do we? But when we're wrestling and striving with difficulties, then we are driven to God. They're designed to produce the fear of God within us. The fear of God means to honor God, to reverence God, to worship God, to trust God. And it is this that brings meaning to life. You are having difficulty making meaning out of life, of course, because you aren't fearing God. Doesn't the Bible tell us many times that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom? You've got to start there. And on that you build. But the fear of the Lord is the foundation of it all. So you start there, honoring Him, reverencing Him, worshiping Him, trusting Him. And when you fear God in that sense, then all of life takes on a different hue. It takes on another color altogether. Life is an enigma by itself. We cannot understand it apart from God. We cannot add or subtract from God's wise design. But the struggles of life and these perplexities that we can't understand are all designed by God to drive us to God so that we might fear Him, because that's the most important element of our lives. You're talking about how to make sense out of life, how to make meaning out of life, what elements of life that you should work on in order to bring fulfillment in life. Well, you've got to start with the foundation. Start with God. Start with trusting Him, worshiping Him, fearing Him, serving Him. Again, the Old Testament version of the Sermon on the Mount. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these other things shall be added unto you. But when you're trying to get contentment, fulfillment, joy, happiness, meaning out of life, out of all these other things, but are pushing God to the background, no, doesn't work that way. The God who made you is telling you how it works, how He designed it. And the perplexities of life are to force you to come to terms with your Maker and to understand that He must be first. Number three, accept the injustices of life as the domain of God. Verses 16 and 17. Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there. And in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and every work. Accept injustices of life as the domain of God. There are injustices. Solomon said, I looked in the place of judgment, and wickedness was there. Where's the place of judgment? That seems to be a reference to government, to the courts, to the place. That's what he's talking about, the location, the place where justice was supposed to be carried out, and instead there was injustice. There was wickedness. Imagine that. And in the place of righteousness, that could be a reference to the temple and the priesthood and the national religion of Israel, or it could have a broader application to the places where righteousness should rule. Again, the institutions of society, the halls of government, as well as the institutions of the workplace, the institutions of the family and home and community and all of these things, in the place where righteousness was supposed to prevail, instead, iniquity was there. Well, nobody disagrees with that. That's the world in which we live. We all know it. And it is frustrating, isn't it? That's frustrating. But I'll tell you how to be really frustrated. To think that you can straighten it all out. And then when you can't, you're going to really be frustrated. Or to think if you can band together with enough like-minded people, you can fix all these things. And then when you can't, you are going to really, 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 really be frustrated. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't address those areas of injustice and unrighteousness that are in our areas of life, in our homes, in our churches, yes, in our government, where we have opportunity to address these things. But If you think this is your domain, you are going to go stark raven mad or else become bitter and disillusioned, one or the other. But if you will yield this to God, this is God's business. And he's not unmindful of this. God knows all about this, and God will judge. You see, he's going to take care of it. All of this is unavoidable in a fallen world. You've got to understand the world in which you live. It is a fallen world, a sinful world, a world that is under the curse of God because of sin. And, dear friends, you can't make it right until the curse is lifted and the curse is related to sin. What can you do most to help with these things? Live a righteous life and proclaim the righteousness of Christ and the righteousness of God's Word and pray for God to instill that in the hearts of as many people as you can. In other words, pray for revival. That's the most of what you can do to affect these things in this world. But if you're going to try to fix all these things, again, apart from God, you're going to fix it all without God's righteousness. You're going to fix all the injustices but leave God out of the picture, like many are trying to do in our day. You are just going to be butting your head against the wall until it's bloody and bruised and bashed. All those things are there and will be there as long as God is pleased to allow them to continue. And when he says that's all, then they'll stop. He's aware of every one of them and he's going to judge every one of them. God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time, there's that word again, for every purpose and for every work. For there is a time, not only a time to be born and a time to die, but a time to be judged by God Almighty. Don't leave that one out. And interestingly, in verse 17, it says, for there is a time, and don't skip that next word, not just a time for every purpose and for every work. There is a time there. And though that's indefinite enough that we cannot be dogmatic about it, that very well may be a reference to heaven. There is a time and a place. The time is God's time and the place is God's throne. In other words, this is all under God's domain. Except the injustices of life as a domain of God. These things are unavoidable in a sinful world, but God will judge in his appointed time and his appointed place. You don't tell him when and where. Therefore, we need to surrender the verdict and solution to these things into his sovereign control. We can't take them away from that anyway, but it's going to make all the difference in the world as to how we live. Whether in our hearts we're willing to yield that to God and trust him to take care of these things in his time and in his way, or whether we're going to chafe at this. Because accepting God's sovereign rule is the key to a right relationship with God. That's what Solomon is telling us. Accepting God's sovereign rule is the key to a right relationship with God. You don't have a right relationship with God until in your heart you are worshiping him as God. And God, by definition, is the one who made it, and God, by definition, is the one who rules it, and God, by definition, is the one who has the right to rule it. You don't even know God. You're not worshiping God when you're worshiping some lesser God that can be ruled and manipulated by men. You don't know the God who is the true God. The key to a right relationship with God is understanding and yielding to his sovereign rule. And then the fourth thing about living in the light of eternity is accept the trials of life as the instructors of God. God tests us, we read in verse 18. I said in my heart concerning the condition of the sons of men, God tests them. He winnows us, You know what winnowing is? The operation by which the wheat is separated from the chaff, and you've got the good part separated from the bad part. God tests us. God purifies us. God separates us to cause us to deal with our earthly mortality. He causes us to struggle so that we'll deal with the realities of eternity. But God also tests us. He winnows us. He buffets us. He separates us to cause us to deal with our earthly mortality. And that's the purpose of these verses in the last part of verse 18 and 19 and 20 about dying and going to the dust and man dying like an animal. And that has been completely misunderstood and misrepresented because, like so many things, it's often taken out of context rather than considered within the context. But what Solomon is saying is something that we all understand, both here and elsewhere in the Bible, that earthly life is like the life of animals. We will die and return to the dust in our earthly existence just like animals do. I read that earlier in Genesis 3:19. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. God said that in the beginning. Does that mean there's nothing more than that? No, that's not what he's saying. He's already told us that there's more than that. He set that foundation before he even came to this statement, so there wouldn't be any misunderstanding about what he's saying. He's not making a statement here, as some have pounced on this and said, see there, the Bible teaches that there's no life beyond the grave, that man is like an animal. The skeptics, the atheists, they love to jump on this, the agnostics, and to make this their life verse. Funny how they'll take things from the Bible that they think agree with them, but reject everything else in the Bible that they don't agree with them. But we all tend to do that. May God help us. But that's not what it's saying. It's only dealing with earthly life. It doesn't say this is all. But what it's saying is to live for this alone is foolish. God tests us so that we'll deal with our mortality because we tend to push that out of mind. Some people will do nearly everything they can to avoid thinking about death. Some people will not prepare a will and will not take care of end-of-life matters because they don't want to think about it. Well, that won't stop it from happening. It'll just make it harder on the ones that are left behind when it does happen. You're not. What are you accomplishing by that? You're failing to deal with reality. I know people who virtually will not go to a funeral home because they don't want to be confronted with a dead body in the casket. They don't want to attend funerals because they don't want to be confronted with death and mortality. Well, you can push it out of mind, but it's not going to change anything. You are still going to the grave. That's the whole point here. You're going to the grave. And God tests us to make us deal with that reality. To live as if there's nothing beyond the grave is the height of folly. But to understand that you're going to the grave, but there's more. He's put eternity in your heart to understand that there's more. That's where wisdom begins. And so God causes us to understand the reality of life beyond the grave. And that brings us to that interesting verse 21. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men which goes upward and the spirit of the animals which goes down to the earth? And that verse has been greatly misunderstood. There's really three ways to understand verse 21. The way it's commonly understood is that this is a question for which Solomon has no answer. Who can know whether there's any life beyond the grave? Who can know that the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the animal goes downward, that there's really any difference between men and animals? I sure can't, some think Solomon is saying, though if you keep reading the book, you know he says the exact opposite in chapter 12. So knowing that, some would say, well, at this point in his life, he didn't understand it. And then he worked his way into true wisdom toward the end of the book, and he didn't understand it. But I think that's the poorest way to understand this verse. There's a second way to understand this verse, and that is a question, not a question for which Solomon has no answer, but a question that focuses upon the immortality of the soul. It's something like, there aren't many people who take to heart the truth that the spirit of man goes upward, unlike the spirit of animals that goes downward. Who does that? Precious few. Everyone should, but men are pushing that out of mind, so many don't do it. That's a better way to understand it, but I think the best way to understand it is not as a question at all, but as a statement. And I can't go into the details of this, but if you want to read them for yourself, get a copy of Walt Kaiser's commentary on Ecclesiastes. It's excellent. It's outstanding. Isn't he a relative of Arlene Wright? I was thinking he was. You got a good one there, Arlene. Get Walt Kaiser's commentary and read what he says about this. And he shows you there's 9 times when this phrase is used in the Bible. This phrase, who knows? And that 3 times it is a question, and 3 times there's something else, and 3 times it's something else. I won't go into all of that. And he's confident that this is one of those times it should not be translated or interpreted as a question, but rather as a statement. It's a statement of man's immortality. The spirit of man goes upward, but the spirit of animals goes downward. That's what he's saying. Yes, man goes to the grave and his body goes back to dust. But don't forget, when that happens, the spirit of man goes upward, unlike the spirit of the animals. It goes downward. You see, when you take it all in context, it's saying the exact opposite of what some people misinterpret this statement to be saying. And a lot of it has to do with our misunderstanding of that word vanity. We dealt with that earlier. But when you understand vanity not to mean futility, that life is futile and the grave is the end, but vanity means brevity, well, it makes perfect sense. We don't live in this world very long, and we're going to the grave. All is brevity. But don't forget, there's a forever beyond, and the spirit of man goes upward, whereas the spirit of animals go downward. So in conclusion, here's what Solomon is telling us in chapter 3. Live in the light of eternity, that is, humbly submitted to the sovereign wisdom of God's absolute control. Always conscious of life beyond the grave and judgment to come. Accepting your life as God has designed it. Living it to the fullest, accepting every element as a gift from God. What is Solomon telling us? He's telling us exactly what we sang at the beginning of our worship this morning. Whate'er my God ordains is right. His holy will abideth. I will be still whate'er he doth and follow where he guideth. He is my God, though dark my road, he holds me that I shall not fall. Wherefore, to him I leave it all. What Solomon is telling us, and I would encourage you to read through that hymn again, all of those stanzas. But what Solomon is telling us is that we are to live with eternity's values in view. Shall we pray? Lord, help us to receive the wisdom that you have given to us in this portion of your word. And to adjust our thinking to line up with the truth that you have revealed, and to accept it gratefully, and to live in the light of it. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.